Podcasting from the Deep Sage 9 Observatory in the high desert near Taos, New Mexico, this is the Deep Sage 9 Starcast. Welcome back to the Starcast for the week of March 1st, 2026. I'm your host, Jay Schaefer, and with me is my co-host, Mike Lewinsky. How are you doing, Mike?
I'm doing great, Jay. Thanks for having me. How are you doing?
Good. Can't beat the weather here for the first day of March. We're coming in like a lamb. So, and so here we go. Mike, what's our space weather? Speaking of weather, what is our space weather looking like over the next couple of days?
Well, Jay, we had a forecast for a minor CME hitting the Earth yesterday, and we did peak up around a 4 kp, so there was some evidence of a CME from a magnetic filament that had erupted on February 25th. But the sun is relatively quiet. Sunspot 4380 poses a threat for M-class solar flares right now. It's one of just a handful of sunspots that have emerged over that eastern limb. And we have no equatorial coronal holes on the Earth side of the sun at this moment. So things are just relatively quiet. Our actual chance of an M-class flare stands around 25% for the next 2 days, and X-class flare chance drops down to 5%. So for mid-latitudes, active condition prediction from NOAA is around 35% chance, and dropping from there, we have only a 1% chance of a severe geomagnetic storm. But if you're up at the higher latitudes, there is a 50% chance of a geomagnetic storm, severe geomagnetic storm today, dropping to 40% tomorrow. So that's where things stand. What's happening in the night sky this week?
Well, the headliner is definitely the total lunar eclipse hitting us on Tuesday morning. It's a set your alarm kind of event because it coincides perfectly with the full moon, as do all full lunar eclipses. The absolute crest of the full moon is at 5:38 a.m. Central Time in the United States on March 3rd. But the real show of the lunar eclipse starts a bit earlier. So if you're awake around 3:50 a.m. Central Standard Time, you'll start seeing the moon creeping into the dark's umbral shadow. Then, from 5:04 to about 6:03 a.m. Central, we get that full-blood moon total eclipse phase. And so, for about an hour. And so, if you're on the East Coast, you might get shortchanged since the moon will be setting before the show wraps up. And so, you know, since the time is earlier there on the East Coast and your sunrise is earlier, the tail part of the eclipse will be after sunrise. But for those of us out here in the mountain and Pacific time zones, we're going to be actually an hour or two earlier than Central Time, and we're in the sweet spot to see the whole thing from start to finish. So stay tuned and stick around, because Mike and I are going to do a deep dive later in the show on exactly how to capture this on camera without losing your mind. All right, Mike. So what's sitting at the top of your radar for space news this week?
Jay, the big news is that NASA is basically hitting the adjust button on the Artemis program. They're pivoting strategy quite a bit, pushing the next crewed lunar lander back to 2028 and actually sliding an entire new mission into the schedule.
So wait, what? Another mission? So Artemis 3 isn't the big moon landing anymore?
Exactly. It's a bit of a throwback, actually. Artemis 3 is now reimagined as a dress rehearsal in Earth orbit, almost exactly like what Apollo 9 did back in the day. They'll be testing docking and life support systems without leaving our immediate neighborhood. The actual boots-on-the-ground moment is getting bumped to Artemis 4. NASA Administrator Jared Isaacman is saying that this is all about standardization, basically getting a repeatable once-a-year launch rhythm going. But a huge part of it is also just giving the landers more time. SpaceX is still working through those tricky Starship refueling tests, while Blue Origin is steady on the heels of their own flight readiness.
Wow, that's a massive pivot. It sounds like a lot of moving parts are being realigned all at once.
Definitely. It feels like they're erring on the side of caution, especially after the technical hiccups and helium leaks that we've seen with Artemis II prep. They'd rather get it right than get it fast.
Makes sense. Safety first when you're headed to the moon. We did that episode on just how difficult the moon can be. So now switching gears to something a bit further out, what's the latest in astronomy news?
Yeah, very cool news out of the Vera C. Rubin Observatory, which just hit a major milestone. Their real-time discovery system is officially live, and it's already spitting out hundreds of thousands of scientific alerts in a single night.
Hundreds of thousands in one night?
It's wild. This thing has the world's largest digital camera, and once the full 10-year survey kicks off, they're expecting up to 7 million alerts every single night. The data is so massive, about 500 petabytes, that professional astronomers literally can't keep up. So they're calling for backup. Anyone listening can jump onto platforms like Zooniverse to help classify these cosmic events. You could literally be the person who flags a new asteroid or a dying star.
I just might have to sign up for Zooniverse. There's something pretty cool about helping map the universe from your laptop. But speaking of looking at the sky ourselves, we've got that lunar eclipse coming up, and it's the last one for a couple years. So we need to talk shop about how we can actually catch this thing on camera.
Absolutely. It's such a one-shot deal. If you miss this window when the moon turns that deep blood red, you're waiting years for the next one. And really, they are surprisingly difficult to photograph.
No kidding. I still have war stories from our trip to Texas for the total solar eclipse and the traffic, the clouds, the gear stress. But you've had some great luck with the last lunar event, haven't you?
I have. The last lunar and that solar eclipse 2 years ago in Texas. And we went with a really dismal forecast. I think it was 75 to 85% cloud forecast. And somehow at totality, the clouds cleared and we got a good view of it. And the last lunar event was similar. I went to bed and said to my partner, hey, if something changes, because it was completely cloudy, and that was our forecast. It was like 90% clouds and snow. And I said, if something changes, wake me up. She came and woke me up, and there was a brief clearing, and we saw the start of the eclipse. And then it clouded up, and I said, okay, I'm going back to bed. Wake me if something happens. And she woke me up, and it had almost completely cleared for the duration of the totality. So you just never know what's going to happen, even with a bad forecast. So
Yeah.
tell me what you're up to, Jay.
Well, it's difficult. The part of the difficulty is that lighting change that always gets me. You go from the bright moon and you've set your exposure, and then within just a few minutes, you're ha having to step down to lengthen your exposure or widen your iris, and so. It's just so fast that your settings are just you're just trying to play catch up, and let's be real, that timing is always brutal. I'm looking at the charts and realize I'm going to be dragging myself out of bed at 3 a.m. just to get the tracking mount aligned.
Yeah, tell me about it. That's the part that people don't see in the final photo. Standing in the yard in your pajamas, shivering, nursing a lukewarm coffee while you triple check your focus. If you aren't out there an hour early or more to monitor your equipment, something will go wrong right at totality. It never seems to fail.
Exactly. You think you've got it automated, and but you still end up babysitting the tripod in the dark. So what exactly are you bringing out in the field this time to make that early wake-up call worth it?
So Jay, I always treat these events as shoot three times or four times and hope for the best. And this is what happened in Texas as well. I had the C-Star, I had my Sony A7R3, I had my Sony A6300, each doing something different. So with the C-Star, I'm in time lapse mode with the and tracking. With the A7R3, I had it mounted on a telescope with a Star Adventure tracking mount. We talked about those in a previous episode. And I had a refractor with the A7 body mounted. And then I had a different telephoto lens on my A6300 and was using that one sort of for more manual shooting. The other two were clicking away automatically. And for this lunar eclipse, I'll be doing pretty much the same thing, except that my 6300 will do a wide field. I really like capturing the rest of the sky, the change from, the bright blue that we get in a long exposure of moonlight, full moon illuminated night sky, into the pitch black, or maybe even with some air glow illuminated at totality. And so I think it's really worth doing one wide field since I have multiple devices. I also am very interested in continuing experiments with tethered shooting. And so I'll just explain that when you take a camera body like the Sony A7 and stick it onto a tracking mount, the point you made earlier about changing exposure settings, aperture, ISO, it becomes a particular challenge because any slight vibration to the camera body is going to, change the framing, and you don't really want to touch it any more than you absolutely have to. So I take a lot of care, and it seems like every time I have the opportunity, I make some minor adjustment and hopefully improvement in my method. One of the things that I have learned the hard way is that it is best to get my mount aligned 24 hours ahead of time if I can, since I need true polar alignment on my mount. I will go out the night before and dial that in and do some test tracking. Then I will toss a cover over the mount just to keep it dry and protected from elements, and leave it right where it is until the night of the eclipse, in the hopes of getting very accurate tracking. Having to adjust tracking in the middle of an eclipse it's a real bummer. So, and I've had the experience of going out, 2 hours before, and it's so cloudy, I can't locate Polaris. So how am I going to do polar alignment if Polaris is not visible? I mean, I do my best, but it's not going to be nearly as good. Also, with that particular mount, I've got to, work on level and balance of the counterweights, to really get things dialed in. I could spend 3 hours the night before just really fine-tuning the tracking. And I'll do the same with the C-Star, because with the equatorial mount, again, I want to, get a pretty decent polar alignment on that and check the level and do some test tracking. Now, then I mentioned tethered shooting, and this is, I think, really where I'm going in the future and for these events. The whole idea is to take a laptop and connect it with a USB cable directly to the camera. And now, instead of having to touch the camera dials to change exposure values, I can do it from the laptop. And that means there's much less, and ideally no touching of the camera or the tripod or the mount or the body. That's the end goal. As a side bonus of that, I get a higher resolution preview, and I get to save each individual frame to my laptop as the event progresses. I have thought about putting up a Twitch stream or a YouTube stream and just refreshing, you know, doing a static, this is what I got on the last capture, this is where we are, you know, maybe some commentary. I don't know that I'm going to have my act together to do it for this event, but I would like to. And I'm generally moving more and more toward that idea of tethered shooting, even on a standard night time lapse. I would like to have a little Raspberry Pi connected to my camera, not just to do adjustments remotely, but also to, you know, feed those images back to my desktop system in the house so that I can kind of keep a closer eye on it and maybe do some more live streams of time lapses for, you know, meteor showers and what have you. So that's kind of where I am. And you know, in our notes, you mentioned bracketed exposures. I have not done bracketed exposures with my time lapses of the eclipse. I believe it's something that I should be doing. The applications that I use that are built into the camera don't support bracketing during time lapse mode. Now, I could use an external intervalometer, but when I do that, I sacrifice the ability to do tethering and or battery power. So I only have two USB ports, and there's limitations on the camera on how many things you can do at once. So it's just kind of a technical challenge. You know, maybe in the future, I will try bracketed exposures with an external intervalometer, but I think the problem I run into there is I can't tether. And if I can't tether, then I've got to be touching the camera to change exposure values, which is absolutely essential. And I just know from bitter experience that it really creates a lot of bouncing in the final result. So what about you, Jay? Are you going wild field or wide field? Or are you trying to get those crater details?
I'm pretty much very similar to kind of your setup in some ways. And I just wanted to ask you really quickly, do you set your ISO or do you use auto ISO in your exposure when you're running those time lapses?
You know, I think there is some value to auto ISO with a lunar eclipse. You know, with a wide field, it gets a little trickier because the camera metering may produce bouncing results, and then you've got a, you know, a flickering effect. So with using a tethered setup, then I'm free to adjust everything as I go along. And I typically start by dropping ISO. And then there comes a point at which I've got to start also reducing my exposure time. Once you get to that blood moon phase, you know, they're pretty long exposures compared to the full moon phase, right? So,
that's pretty much. So what I'm going to be trying is I have a Canon full frame camera, and I'll be taking that, and I'll have that on my Skywatcher mount, which is an alt azimuth mount, and I will be using a C90 90 millimeter telescope as the lens for that, and so that will be kind of shooting a time lapse, and hopefully I can automate that and have that run all night long. And I'm going to try to have that set with auto ISO to try to chase the exposure without me having to get onto and and adjust that manually. And like you said about tethering, now I haven't actually tried USB tethering to a laptop or like you said, a Raspberry Pi. I just have the apps for the various cameras that I have on my phone. And so what I'm kind of doing is I'm juggling between these apps, and a lot of them don't really have a station mode for Wi-Fi, and they all have their own ad hoc Wi-Fi, and so I'm kind of like hopping between Wi-Fi networks to try to adjust those cameras. So that's something that I need to probably pick your brain about, is actually doing that USB tethering. And then I'm also going to be running the C-Star, like you said, as an equatorial mount. And I've actually got my tripod kind of permanently set up out there, and with the mount actually kind of pre-polar aligned. And so for the most part, I've been able to just take my C-Star and mount it on the equatorial mount, and just quickly check the settings for the star alignment, for the polar alignment, and it's been actually pretty good. And I did want to talk a little bit about the C-Star specifically. So as I imagine, many of our listeners actually have a C-Star S50 telescope, and one of the things that that's difficult with the C-Star is actually just finding the moon. And there's been many occasions where I've gone out there and just been super frustrated with the C-Star being able to find the moon. And then I kind of came across a technique that helps me do that. And that is that I go into the stargazing mode, where I'm going to be looking at deep space objects, and go to the Sky Atlas, and I find something that's near where the moon is at, and then I sight on that and have the telescope go to that. And then I'll usually try to do a couple little targets just so that it's kind of triangulating. And then finally, in the Star Atlas itself, there's usually the moon is shows up in the Star Atlas, and then I'll target that within the Star Atlas, and then that will go to the moon. And then I can, in stargazing mode, and then I can, once it finds the moon, I switch out of that, and then I go back to lunar mode. And that seems to be my best workflow for getting that to work. And then finally, like you're talking about the wide field, so I'm going to try what I would call almost wide field. I'm going to try using the my little tracking mount, that Chinese one, the T-Seek, and I'm going to mount the Micro Four Thirds camera, the Lumix G100, and I'm going to try using a 150mm lens or a 300mm equivalent lens on that crop frame sensor. And that I'm hoping that that's wide enough that the moon's not going to go out of frame from the tracker, but close enough that I'm actually able to see crater details and when it goes into that moon phase. And I'm going to be trying to, again, try to control all these cameras from their particular apps on my phone. So I'm going to be having the app for the Canon camera, the app for the Skywatcher mount, the app for the T-Seek tracker, and the app for the C-Star S50. So that's kind of turning into a management nightmare as well. Like, so.
you need a bot farm of cell phones.
Yeah, yeah.
There are some folks overseas to adjust your exposure.
Yeah, there we go. Crowdsource it, or yeah, just get several burner phones and run their individual phones. But yeah, actually, that's a good idea, in that I can probably actually run an iPad as well as my phone to control some of the things. So that's kind of my plan. But and again, I'm hoping to wake up in time, and hopefully I can mostly automate the process. And, like you had said with the tethering, USB tethering, That means that the computer has to be outside, and that means that you might have to be outside as well. And so that, and but I think it's a great idea that what you were talking about of using Raspberry Pi and then probably hooking up to that through VNC so that you can stay inside and warm and still change all those parameters.
Right.
So what about the weather factor?
Yeah, we have, we're in a kind of a valley at that window right now. I've been watching the weather for the last week, and it's been, the forecast has been improving. A week ago today, when the Weather Underground window opened for the eclipse period, they were predicting between 65 to 70% chance of clouds, which is pretty, you know, discouraging. But I said, well, that's a week out. Things are going to change. So don't get excited. Don't get disappointed. Just wait. And sure enough, our current forecast here in Crestone puts us between 15, 20% chance of clouds at the eclipse window on Tuesday morning. Now, we're in a, like I say, we're in a valley. There's, you know, significant clouds coming in today, and then clearing overnight. Tomorrow, then clearing overnight. And then again on Tuesday, there's clouds coming in. So, you know, so long as these systems don't speed up or slow down, I appear to have good conditions.
Okay, well, it's just always the kind of the Zen part of astronomy is to, you know, accept those things that you can't control, and you know, and weather is one of those. I mean, again, you can do planning and observing, and like you said, your rehearsal would be to have to be tonight, wouldn't it, for the Tuesday morning event?
Yeah, I'm gonna start tonight. Get my equipment, you know, in shape and mounted and dialed in as best as I can, just in case tomorrow night is too cloudy. And I want to also, Jay, mention a couple apps that folks might want to keep in mind for events like this, especially if you are further east. One is the Photographer's Ephemeris, which they have an iPhone app and they have a website. And it's very good for helping you calculate where a particular celestial body is going to rise or set on the horizon. The other one, which I am using today, is the application Stellarium. And that's not only a mobile phone app, but they make that for Windows, Mac, and Linux platforms. And there's a little hack for Stellarium. If you use the website heywhatsthat.com, you can generate a elevation profile map for your particular location. I've got a lot of mountains to my east that are very close that obscure a lot of what I can see. And I can download that profile and then import it as my horizon in Stellarium. So when I load up Stellarium, I can see exactly where something is rising over the east. Now, for this particular event, the moon is going to be pretty well up in the western sky, but pretty high above the horizon during this eclipse. So it's not directly useful in this event, but if I was further east, it might be. If I happen to be, you know, have a big range of mountains right to my west, I might want to know, is this worth my time, you know, and to accommodate, you know, do I want to drive an hour east, right, or an hour west for an event like this? You know, you can use the mapping tool to kind of do the projections for wherever you will be. I will also say that, you know, I was looking at Stellarium, and the application lets you go forward and backward in time, and it has the eclipse built right in. So I get to see, you know, what that's going to look like in particular, you know, how the, which side of the moon the eclipse is going to appear to start on, right? So highly recommend it. Stellarium's free software. The desktop version has a lot more functionality that the mobile version doesn't, but the mobile version does have an AR mode that I find very useful.
We'll put a link to all those in our show notes. And I use both Sky Safari and Starwalk 2 as apps that along those same lines as Stellarium. And then there's another app that I have. It's called Photo Pills, and that actually has an augmented reality function for moonrises and sunrises and sunsets and that sort of thing, where you actually kind of use your camera on your phone, aim at the direction, and it will show you superimposed where the moon is going to rise. And just a note on this, one of the things I was doing this rehearsal over the last couple nights with using my Skywatcher mount. And it's an old azimuth mount, and with the moon being, well, with it being so close to the equinox, the moon is traveling very high in the sky, right at, it's actually going to be almost at the zenith at midnight on Tuesday. And so this is actually presents a problem with my mount, is if it gets to the zenith, it basically freezes up because it's as high as the arm can go on it. And then and basically I have to go out there after midnight, after it gets after the past the zenith, and kind of rotate it around or just realign it or restart it once it passes that zenith. So that's something that's another fly in the soup that's going to
Sure.
make this high on the difficulty scale, so that the Russian judges can judge us, severely. At the end of the night, what are you hoping to get out of the from the eclipse? What are you? What's your best hope for getting with your photography?
Yeah, if the clouds play nice and we didn't freeze for nothing, I really want that one clean, high resolution shot of peak totality color and, a smooth transition of time lapse. If it can be a little smoother than my last one, I'll be happy. And we'll include maybe a link to that particular time lapse in our show notes as well.
Yeah, and I'm honestly, I've had such bad luck with the time lapses, and that, if that comes out, that's great. But if I can get the, I call it the seven shots, where it's just as the umbra is starting on the, and then when it's half obscured, and then three quarter obscured, and then totality, and then the reverse out of that, where
Yeah.
again, and if I can get that seven shot well framed and well exposed, I'll be a happy camper. So that's what we're doing for the eclipse, and hopefully that helps some our listeners and planning for their eclipse photography. So we want to thank all our listeners for checking out this podcast, and be sure to comment, like, and subscribe, and let us know what you'd like to hear more about. You can also check out our individual websites at wildernessvagabonds.com and skylapser.com. And you can check out Mike's time lapses and his time lapse from the last lunar eclipse on his the Mike Lewinsky YouTube channel. And you can see what I've got there on my YouTube channel as well, the Skylapser YouTube channel. The intro music is Fanfare for Space by Kevin MacLeod from the YouTube Audio Library. From the Deep Sage 9 Observatory, this is Jay Schaefer and
Mike Lewinsky.
wishing you all clear skies and a bloody eclipse.